Tap into the passion and vision of well-known entertainment luminaries with Thinking Out Loud. Go on a journey with unfiltered access to today's media innovators. Hear their strategy for rising above the crowded landscape. Important lessons and valuable wisdom that only comes from real industry experience.
Hello, I'm Vicki Lins, President and CEO of CTAM, a marketing organization focused on the media, entertainment, and technology industry. Today, I'm speaking with Linda Hill, Professor of Business Administration and Chair of the Leadership Initiative at the Harvard Business School. Linda has been named one of the top 10 management thinkers in the world and is regarded as one of the world's top experts on leadership. And her TED Talk on how to manage for collective creativity has over 2 million views. Linda, I think your educational background is really interesting. You have your PhD in behavioral sciences, bachelor's is in psychology. So hopefully that's prepared you well for the consulting work you do. I know that you work with companies like Pixar and Google and others around the innovation and inclusion space, and serve as an advisor and do research as well. Lots to talk about today. You're also the author of several books, most notably Collective Genius, The Art and Practice of Leading Innovation. And I thought that's where I would lead off with our conversation today. Why don't you define for us, what is collective genius?
Collective genius is really a recognition of how innovation happens. Collective genius is about the fact that innovation is not the result of an individual having an aha moment. What we've known for decades is that most innovation is the result of collaborative activity amongst people who come together to solve a problem that matters to all of them. And so it really is figuring out how to unleash the diverse slices of genius in the organization to get useful solutions to problems that their customers or other stakeholders have.
We didn't tee this up on purpose, but it strikes me that what you've just said is truly at the heart and soul of CTAM, where innovation is truly about collaboration with a very diverse group of industry leaders who are coming together to either leverage a collective opportunity or solve a collective problem.
The fact of the matter is we know that if you want to really have impact and do something at scale, it involves lots of people. And what I think has been my passion is how to help leaders understand how they lead in a way that they actually unleash that collective power. It's not about you as a leader telling people, this is the answer, follow me, particularly nowadays. It's much more about, okay, here's a problem or an opportunity we need to address, and how do we collect together the individuals and groups necessary to tackle whatever that opportunity and problem is.
What type of equity does a leader have to have to be able to be that authentic, transparent, and confident that he won't create reason for concern among the employee base when you have a conversation like that that says, I don't know these things, I don't have these answers. We need to figure this out together.
Everyone that we studied in our study of exceptional leaders of innovation, all of their organizations did do breakthrough innovations of some sort. But what they soon learned was they had to make space for other people's visions. So I think to be credible and trusted to do this, people need to think that you do have a point of view that's valuable. They don't want to work with someone who they consider, you know, mediocre in his or her own imagination about how to pursue opportunities or deal with problems. So the challenge they have for themselves, frankly, is how to make the space for other people to be included in the discussion. So we know that trust for us is about the leader's competence, and they want to know about the leader's character. So they therefore want to know about your intention. Are you really wedded to this purpose? Is this really the meaning and why the work's going to matter to whomever it is that you're trying to get done for you to build the kinds of relationships? And one of the things we know in big organizations is that you prove your character, is that you're very transparent about what you do and why. You'll talk to people about why. You're willing to have them ask you questions. They can inquire and not just advocate. So in one organization we saw that was trying to change its leadership to behave more in ways like I'm describing to you, they literally hired a coach who counted the number of times the senior team asked questions versus the number of times they advocated for a point of view, so that they could get that balance right. Because it's not like you want to sit there with a leader who has nothing to say, no good questions, whatever. So they are deeply engaged. It's not that anything goes and everything goes. And quite, there are boundary conditions and constraints these leaders put in place. And they're willing to stand up when you cross over the line. They're actually not afraid to say, you crossed over the line, how you've been behaving. They'll be the first one to point out, you're not behaving in a way that will encourage others to feel safe in our environment to say what they really think.
We are in an industry that is going through unparalleled disruption and reinvention. There's a lot of talk about innovation. It's tossed around a lot. In reality, innovation is a lot of hard work. It's an all-in proposition, as you just talked about, with a shared sense of purpose and responsibility. So how do you build an agile organization where everyone can participate in that innovative problem solver role, you know, from a traditional framework that's already in place in any given company? Because that's really what we're seeing, is companies trying to go from where they've been to where they need to be and to do it fast.
Yeah, you know, so that's what we have been studying, as you know, Vicki, lately. We've been looking at organizations who are trying to transform themselves to be more agile. We know that organizations or people rarely change, because organizations are made up of people, unless those people truly are dissatisfied. And it's not simply dissatisfied with the status quo. They have to be dissatisfied with themselves and their own role in creating that status quo. So one of the most difficult things to do as a leader is to help people feel dissatisfied with their role in creating the status quo. One of the primary reasons why companies don't change is that the people who needed to change were not dissatisfied. So what we find is that when you go back and look at organizations that have been really stuck, there hasn't been an effort to help individuals understand how they have helped create that status quo. So some of the companies we've studied, they've been growing very fast, if you will, but not as fast as the competition. And so that creates a problem. So what you see in these organizations that are very innovative is people have a deep sense of accountability. And they actually understand that they have impact. I cannot tell you how often we find that there's such a disconnect between where senior management is and what they see and know needs to be different, and others in the organization who also see that things need to be different, but their diagnosis of why things have gone wrong is just quite different. So when you don't start solving the same problem, you know, you end up in a quandary. That's why you benefit from having people, from transparency, having people understand, for instance, how we actually do make money, what really does matter to the customer. You want them to continually know that information, and people who care about the purpose of the organization and who they're trying to serve will come to you and let you know, as leaders will tell me, we're not doing as good a job as we need to do. But if you haven't set it up that way and you at the top are the ones who have to, you know, send the message, cascade it down through the organization, the first task you have is getting these people to feel some accountability for the outcomes of the organization, which they may or may not feel. That's what we find in many organizations. That's deadly for you as you try to move.
You talked about how disruption happens when companies cannot innovate. Mm-hmm. And that leaves them exposed. Is that part of what we're seeing in the media industry today? Were we not as innovative as we thought we were being? And so this is where the disruption has come in to play? Or do you see the inevitable evolution of the business landscape continually challenging businesses to always innovate and re-innovate?
One of the things that I would say is there is evidence that the speed at which you have to get things done in organizations has gone up, you know, as a result mostly of technology. So that speed factor makes a difference. And so it used to be that scale could be how you competed, and you had some time before the startups or the competitor was going to ever really catch up with you. But that's not happening so much because of technology. You can have very different business models that allow you to undermine the traditional competitor. It's actually when you can have scale and speed that seems to make, that's who finds it easiest to compete these days. But scale and speed don't normally go together, if you will. I'm writing my next book with an executive from Salesforce. And one of the things we've been talking about is, you know, how they very early on adopted a more agile way of doing their product development, but also just everything about how they worked and how that has allowed them to be more competitive. They had to do that because they had a subscription model, right? People had to sign up every month as opposed to they have this legacy software that is going to kill them to change. So they forced themselves early on to have to be faster and to offer something of value that the customer valued differently, you know, often enough for them to always re-up. And so they built into the organization the need to stay deeply competitive by innovating. But I think that what happens in many big companies, as you well know, and this is about the disruption, is if you're a really big company, when I was writing about IBM a number of years ago now, to make a difference, when they look at business opportunities, and I'm sure this is, you know, in media companies as well, you look and think, well, is it really worth disrupting ourselves to do that thing that may not move the needle? That's what you often hear. And this is where the board comes in and why I did work on boards and innovation. Because if you're already so huge, to build a new business that's truly going to make that big business grow in a substantial way and show that in any short, medium-term way is really difficult. So what they do is these big companies, they've seen the opportunity, but they've rejected it. Because it's not meaningful to them relative to their revenue growth, relatively speaking, whereas to a new company starting up, it is. So what you see is a disruption usually comes. It's not that the big company didn't know that that might be a way that a customer would like to be approached or whatever it might be. It's that they thought, well, wait a minute, we're already at this, you know, our revenue is this high. That's only going to make us, that's 1% growth or whatever it is. So they don't do something that actually the customers are beginning to show an interest in, and then they really get behind. And I want to be careful about this. There's a consulting firm that actually used to have a website on how fast you could die. It showed you, given what industry you're in, how fast are you going to die today as opposed to 5 years ago, 10 years ago? And that's one of those ways in which speed matters, getting it right. So that is what we need to compete. Organizations are really beginning to see that, and one of the ways they respond is what, you know, it's called an ambidextrous organization. You have your core business, but you set up another unit. That's what we looked at Comcast. You set up another unit out there that's sort of doing things differently, an innovation lab, a corporate accelerator, whatever it might be. You're sort of developing some of that new out there so that the big organization doesn't eat it alive before it gets to grow, right, a bit and test itself. And then you got to figure out how to integrate what you're doing out there inside the core business. Now, that integration process, as it turns out, is a very difficult one. There's a lot of advice to do it that way, but we don't really know yet how much it pays off. You see all kinds of new structures. I'm sure you're seeing it in your industry. Or what they also do is they acquire. Hopefully, you don't acquire just to shut down the competitor, which is not what you're supposed to do, not legal anyway. You actually, what they hope to do is acquire the expertise, right? These acquisitions are about the people. You see all of these different strategies that companies are trying to try to speed up their capacity to change quickly. And I think there are stories of successes, and it's not an easy process because then you have to build an organization that's more collaborative ready, that knows how to take in these partners. Because we're seeing, like in blockchain, we're seeing very, quote, established companies who need certain kinds of expertise actually building out partnerships with sometimes other big companies or maybe small companies, or collaborating with other big companies to create a capability. Okay, you're in the defense business, I'm in the pharmaceutical business, but we both need to really figure out how to do VR, AR in a much, much better way. Let's join together, improve the technology and the experience, and I'll use it for my industry and you use it for yours. So all kinds of very innovative, if you will, ways that I'm seeing organizations try to tackle how do we get more speed in innovation in our organization.
It's a bit scary. It's a bit overwhelming. These are big, weighty challenges. So what advice do you have for companies that are trying to become more agile, trying to innovate at a different level than they have been, need to engage their employees in this process, and have to do it quickly?
You do need to think about risk differently, and you do need to think about doing nothing is risk. That's probably the riskiest choice of all, to do nothing. When you look and say, well, we're already this big, and if we do this, we're not really going to get, quote, much benefit, right? You also always need to be dealing with your costs, but what really makes a difference, particularly in this environment, and what, given that customer expectations about what their experience should be is just going up, right? You need to be willing to, quote, understand that you're going to have to take risks. You need to develop an organization where the talent in the organization understands they need to be value creators and game changers, everybody, not just the top. So you want everyone to know that we always need to be thinking about what we should be doing for whomever our stakeholders are and what we could be doing for whomever our stakeholders are. You need to develop the capabilities to be able to help close gaps that we see. We had the privilege of doing some research on Procter & Gamble. And one of the things that they said at Procter & Gamble, Kathy Fish, who was the, one of the things was the head of R&D, said, we need to raise people's ambitions to be bolder in what they're doing, because that is the only way we will really move Procter & Gamble forward. But what we have is we have a lot of people who are executors, but not people who are real comfortable taking risk. And it's not that they're bad people or that they wouldn't want to do it. We don't actually reward them for that. So they put in a whole lean innovation growth work story to really change the mindset of what everyone's job was fundamentally, and talked about these irresistibly superior, you know, experiences that customers were supposed to pursue, that you're supposed to pursue those. And as they put in growth works, they also found that they needed to look at their career system, because people weren't rewarded for learning fast, i.e. having a misstep as you try to do something that's bolder. And they've had to they're practicing, they've innovated on innovation on their career tracks. HR is innovating. Then they had to go to finance and innovate on how they actually think about financing products, because, or I should say projects, because what happens is they know their finance department is set up to only finance and invest in sort of large sums of money, not small sums to do testing and iterating. So I must say Kathy Fish and what she's been working on in Procter & Gamble, fabulous example of coming together and stepping back and going back to the basics of what we're telling people their jobs are, getting people to reimagine what needs to happen, and then being honest about the fact that we have to rework all of our systems to learn how to innovate differently. So I think that P&G is one of those companies, great American company, all of us saw and see as very innovative, but understood they were being, the startups were coming in and picking at different product lines, and they needed to step back and say, it's very much your responsibility to think in your business unit, your product line, whatever it might be, what's that could, it's your responsibility to make sure someone is, that you're telling the senior management about that, and the senior management's being educated on how to act more like venture capitalists. The head of marketing, he said advertising will no longer exist. It won't exist. So imagine a P&G and the head of chief marketing officer talking about the day very soon when advertising won't exist, and how much he's trying to get the company to be able to work in that kind of world. And that's something that obviously you all in media would all have to be very concerned about as well, and you are, because of how that all works. But they're now setting themselves, the senior management, saying these things that we always were really good at knowing how to use, they're not going to exist very shortly. And even going to CES was, I think, a relatively new experience for Procter & Gamble this last year. But what does that mean to have a product, someone with product, and say, there will be no advertising? Well, I know advertising agencies know what that feels like, right? It's going to be more direct to consumer. It's going to be much more personalized. How does a big company like Procter & Gamble that has so much skill learn to operate that way?
That's a fascinating example, because we are in an industry right now where we're weighted down with legacy business models, legacy relationships, legacy approaches to certain things, with very big disruption rolling in. And the pandemic has amplified and accelerated a lot of the change that was already starting to take hold. And so now the question remains to be seen, how fast can we adapt? How quickly can these organizations embrace agility? And what are the key drivers that we need to pay attention to try to drive innovation the way you're defining it? One of the themes that cuts across your work is diversity and inclusion. And you mentioned earlier the diversity of thought. I think you look at diversity and inclusion from a very different perspective in terms of how it impacts and or impedes innovation. Is that one of the key drivers that we really focusing on in order to accomplish these bigger shifts?
Yeah, so I think what we mean by inclusion is that an organization values differences and on the other end promotes opportunity. And so equal opportunity. So what that means in terms of diversity of thought, we definitely found you very rarely get innovation without diversity of thought. But what we found is that there's not as much diversity of thought that is unleashed in most organizations. Silence is seen as consent. And we can put this in the virtual world now. So if people don't speak up, and we all have, you know, our fatigue from being on whatever platform you use, if people don't speak up, people assume that person is in agreement. And of course, that may or may not be true. So what we see in terms of leaders who build organizations that can innovate is they actually work hard to amplify differences. They will ask the silent person, what do you think? And there's lots of research that shows if you go around the room, even the virtual room, and ask, what do you think, what do you think, what do you think, you actually get better solutions. And it's partly because you cannot manage risk if you don't hear from everybody. And people don't like to say the unpopular thing or be the contrarian point of view. Actually, this was the former chairman of Sony. I was in Japan with him. And we were talking about creative abrasion and why you need diversity of thought. As I was leaving, as Professor Hill, he said it in a very, you know, in a very formal way, I'm being casual. When I was about to retire, I realized that part of the problem was that people waited on me to have the answers. So I went to a meeting, and you know, and he said something, and then right after he said it, he said, someone said, "Yes, I agree, chairperson." Yes, I agree. And it hit him, for whatever reason, that that's what always happened in every one of his meetings, that he would say something, and then one person would agree, and then everybody would agree. So this time, he actually said to the person who agreed, okay, if you agree with me, I know you're a very busy executive, you can leave the meeting now, because I know what you think. He said, how about anybody else? Of course, there was complete silence. I mean, I can't even imagine, right? I can't imagine any organization this happening. He said, no, really, you can leave the meeting. And you could hear a pin drop in this audience of must have been 400, 500 very senior executives of Japanese company when the former chairman of Sony said this. And then he ended up saying to them at some point, you know what, if we come to our next meeting, I'm not going to speak. If no one speaks, then there will be silence until someone speaks. And I think he described at the next meeting that I think there was silence for almost 20 minutes. Because no one wanted to say something that he was going to disagree with. But he said, this is my legacy. I wanted to leave for my successor the fact that I had taught this senior team that they needed to say what they really thought. Because it's not that people don't have different points of view, that you don't have diversity of thought. It's not being expressed. And unless you, as a leader, make it really easy for people to say what they really think, particularly if it's in disagreement with what you've said or to ask you a question, they're not going to. You're the one who sets the stage for that. So I think it's kind of human nature in a way that we don't like to make people uncomfortable. We don't really like to disagree. There are some people who are different than that. So you as a leader have to create that environment. And usually if you have people with different lived experiences, that will impact the more diversity of thought you have. Creating inclusiveness, but having those people have influence. So I think that this matters even more now that we figure these things out. Not only to be able to just, you know, do business in a more agile way, but also I think we're all very alerted to what happens to communities when you have these breakdowns between different demographic groups. That you can't have that in an organization. I actually think business is going to be one of the more progressive drivers of more progressive thinking about inclusion than perhaps other sectors even. Because we know who the talent is that we need to be bringing in. We understand who our audiences are, and particularly in the spaces you're in. They're very diverse demographically, particularly, you know, with entertainment and media.
That's brought us almost full circle to where we started in terms of culture and an all-in mentality on everyone on the team being involved. I don't want to leave you without bringing it back to the people who are listening to this episode, many of whom are not the senior leadership of their organizations, but maybe the mid-level or entry-level employees in organizations. And what role do they play in being empowered to help drive innovation in their organizations?
understand that your job is not simply to manage that team, the people who formally report to you, but also manage your network, the people who don't report to you, over whom you and your team are deeply dependent. So one of the things I do very much with people who are in the middle, this is, who are you really dependent on, you and your team, to get your job done? How do you personally, and also prepare your team to build the kind of relationships you need to with peers and bosses to actually make sure you're aligned in your priorities and what you're doing as a team and what the organization sees as a priority, and that you actually have access to the resources you need? And that's about the networking piece. That network piece is leadership, and how do you think about it as leadership and have that mindset about it, as opposed to it being about, quote, politics. Because many people will say, I just do my job. I don't do that other stuff. Well, guess what? You have to do that other stuff, and that other stuff is actually leadership. To make sure you as a more middle manager can, you know, do what you can do to create the value creators and the game changers on your own team to actually be able to move and have your team be ready to do the kind of work and collaborate with others that I'm describing, is if you don't manage that, you will be powerless. And all of those shoulds and coulds that you see out there, because you're scanning and sensing what's going on and, you know, out there in the world, keep your, always look out, always look out, not in, sense and scan what's going on there. And you're matching that with what you're hearing from your organization about what matters. And you need to have some moral, some imagination and courage to kind of speak up about what you're really seeing and hearing. Talking to people to find out, when is it a weak signal that this is beginning to happen? Because once it's a trend, you're already late. You do need to make sure you're scanning and sensing so that you're confident, that people can trust that you know what the latest and greatest is that's happening in your area of responsibility. And then in terms of your character, they need to know that you're always doing what's best for the enterprise, not simply what's best for your part of the organization. And then in the same spirit, you're building a team that knows how to be collaborative, ready to work with others in the network to get done what the enterprise needs to get done.
Well, as you pointed out in the beginning of our conversation, impact at scale involves a lot of people. And so there is a role that each of us should play, can play, and hopefully will play after hearing all of your insights and you sharing some of your information with us today. Thank you so much for spending this time with us. And it's been a real pleasure speaking with you.
It's really been my pleasure. And I love your industry. So please, anytime. Thank you and all the best.
Hope you found this Thinking Out Loud conversation interesting and perhaps even thought-provoking. There are more on the way. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and leave a review.